The hawking party, 100 horsemen strong, left Issakandarabad and rode along the edge of the cliff that looked down upon the dry river course hundreds of feet below. The lowering sun cast mysterious blue shadows over the splendid chaos of tumbled walls and cliffs and serpentine wadis. "Why would Alexander choose such a wild and desolate place to build a city?" Verity wondered aloud. 3,000 years ago there was a mighty river, and the valley floor would have been a garden of green," Mansur replied. "It is sad to think that so little is left of such a mighty enterprise. He built so much, and it was destroyed in a single lifetime by the lesser men who inherited it from him. Even Issakanda's tomb is lost." Gradually Mansur lured her into conversation, and slowly she lowered her guard and responded to him more readily. He was delighted to find in her a companion who shared his love of history, but as their discussion deepened, he found that she was a scholar, and her knowledge exceeded his own. He was content to listen to her rather than express his own opinions. He enjoyed the sound of her voice and her use of the Arabic language. The huntsmen had scouted the desert for days before, and they were able to lead the caliph to the most likely area in which they might find game. This was a wide, level plain, studded with clumps of low salt bush. It stretched away to the limit of the eye. Now, as it cooled, the air was sweet and clear as a mountain stream, and Verity felt alive and vital. Yet there was a restlessness in her, as though something extraordinary was about to happen, something that might change her life for ever. Suddenly Al-Salil called for a gallop, and the horns rang out. They spurred forward together like a squadron of cavalry. Hooves drummed on the hard-baked sand, and the wind sang past Verity's ears. The mare ran lightly under her, seeming to skim the ground like a swallow in flight, and she laughed. She looked over at Mansur, who rode beside her, and they laughed together for no other reason than that they were young and full of the joy of life. Suddenly there was a shriller horn blast. A shout of excitement went up from the huntsmen. Ahead of the line, a pair of bustards had been started from the cover of the salt bushes by the thunder of hooves. They ran with their necks outthrust, their heads held low to the ground. They were huge birds, larger than a wild goose. Although their plumage was cinnamon brown, blue and dark red, it was so cunningly blended to match the desert terrain that they seemed ethereal and as insubstantial as wraiths. At the sound of the horn, the line of riders reined in. The horses milled, circled, and chewed their bits, eager to run again, but they held their places in the line while Al-Salil rode forward with a falcon on his wrist. It was a desert saker, the loveliest and fiercest of all falcons. In the short time they had been in Oman, Dorian had made this particular bird his favourite. It was a tercel, and therefore the more beautiful gender of the species. At 3 years of age, it was at the peak of its strength and swiftness. He had named it Kamzin, after the furious desert wind. With the line of horsemen halted, the bustards had not been driven into flight. They had gone back into cover in the salt bush. They must have been lying flat against the earth with their long necks thrust out. They remained still as the desert rocks that surrounded them, concealed from the eyes of the hunters by their colouring. Al-Salil walked his mount slowly towards the patch of scrub where they had last been seen. Excitement built in the line of watchers. Although Verity did not share the passion of the true falconer, she found her breath coming short, and the hand that held the reins was trembling slightly. She glanced sideways at Mansur, and his features were rapt. For the first time she felt herself completely in tune with him. Suddenly there was a harsh croaking cry, and from under the front hooves of Al-Salil's stallion, a huge body launched itself into flight. Verity was astonished at how swiftly and strongly the bustard rose into the air. The whistling beat of the wings carried clearly in the silence. Their span was as wide as the full stretch of a man's arms, blunt at the tips and deep as they hurled the bird aloft. The watchers began a soft chant as the caliph slipped the hood off the tercel's marvellously savage head. It blinked its yellow eyes and looked to the sky. The bass drummer began a slow beat that boomed out across the plain, exciting both watchers and falcon. "Kamzin! Kamzin!" they chanted. The tercel saw the bustard outlined against the hard blue and baited against the jesses that restrained him. He hung for a moment upside down, beating his wings as he struggled to be free. The caliph lifted him high, slipped the jesses, and launched him into the air. On swift, blade-sharp wings, the tercel rose higher and higher, circling. His head moved from side to side as he watched the huge, flapping bird that sped across the plain below him. The drummer increased the beat, and the watchers raised their voices. "Khamsin! Khamsin!" The tercel reached the heights, a tiny black shape on sickle wings against the steely blue, towering over his massive prey. Then abruptly he cocked his wings back and dropped like a javelin, plummeting towards the earth. The drummer beat a frenetic crescendo, then abruptly cut it short. In the silence they heard the wind fluting over the wings, and the tercel's stoop was so swift as to cheat the eye. He hit the bustard with a sound like the clash of fighting stags' antlers. The bustard seemed to burst into a cloud of feathers that streamed away on the breeze. A triumphant cry went up from 100 throats. Verity found that she was gasping as though she had surfaced from a deep dive below the sea. Al-Salil recovered his falcon, fed him the bustard's liver, and stroked him while he gulped it down. Then he called for another bird. With it on his wrists, he rode ahead with Sir Guy and most of his counsellors. In the passion of the hunt that gripped them all, there was no discussion. Verity was no longer needed to translate for them, and she lingered with Mansur. Subtly, he slowed his horse, and she kept pace with him, so wrapped in their talk that she seemed not to realize they were falling further and further behind the caliph's party. The antagonism between them evaporated as they talked, and both were animated by the other's proximity. When Verity laughed, it was a fetching sound that delighted Mansur, and her handsome, rather austere features were enlivened almost to the point of beauty. Slowly they forgot the large, colourful entourage in which they rode, and became isolated in the midst of the multitude. A distant shout and the beat of the war drum jerked them back to reality. Mansur rose in his stirrups and shouted with astonishment, "Look! Do you not see them?" The men around them were shouting, and the horns blared out. The drummers beat a frenzy. "What is it? What has happened?" His change of mood was infectious, and Verity pressed up close beside him. Then she saw what had caused the pandemonium. On the far slope of the valley, the small party of huntsmen led by Al-Salil was at full gallop. While casting for bustard, they had put up much more dangerous game. "Lions!" Mansur cried. 10 at least, maybe more. Come, follow me. We must not miss this sport." Verity pushed her mare to keep pace with him as they raced down their side of the valley. The pride that Al-Salil and his hunters were driving before them were swift, tawny shapes darting through the patches of saltbush, flitting in and out of the steep-sided wadis that rent the tortured desert ground. The caliph had passed his falcon to one of the hunters, and they had all snatched their long weapons from the lance-bearers. They were in full chase after the pride, their cries thin and faint with distance. Then there was a sudden terrible roar of pain and fury as Al-Salil leaned from the saddle and speared one of the swift shapes. Verity saw the lion, bowled over by the lance thrust, rolling and bellowing in a cloud of pale dust. Al-Salil cleared his weapon with an expert backward sweep and rode on after his next victim, leaving the downed lion grunting its last with the lung blood pumping from its jaws. The riders coming up behind him lanced the dying beast again and again. Then another of the huntsmen scored with the lance, and another, and all became a wild confusion of racing horses and fleeing yellow cats. The hunters shouted each time they hit. The horses whinnied and shrilled under them, driven mad by the smell of lion blood mingled with the roaring of the wounded cats. The horns blew, the drums pounded, and the dust shrouded it all. Mansur snatched a lance from the bearer who rode behind him and galloped after his father. Verity kept pace with him, but the hunt swept away over the crest of the hill before they could join in with the sport. They passed two dead lions stretched out among the saltbush. Their carcasses were riddled with wounds, and the horses shied at the terrifying scent. By the time they reached the ridge and looked over, the hunt was scattered across the plain. Almost a mile away, they could make out Al-Salil's distinctive figure in his flowing white robes leading the hunt. But there was no longer any sign of the lion pride. They had disappeared, like brown smoke, into the vastness of the desert. "Too late," Mansur lamented, and reined in his mount. "They have run away from us. We will simply use up the horses to no profit if we try to chase after them." "Your Highness," in her agitation, Verity did not seem aware that she had used his title. "I had a glimpse of one of the lions breaking away along the ridge." She pointed off towards the left. "It seemed to be heading back towards the river." "Come then, my lady," Mansur turned his stallion back. "Show me where you saw it." She led him along the high ground, and then at an angle off the skyline. Within a quarter of a mile they were out of sight of the rest of the entourage, cantering alone through the wilderness. The excitement was still high in both of them, and they laughed together without reason. Verity's hat blew from her head, and when Mansur would have turned back to retrieve it, she called, "Leave it! We shall find it later!" She tossed her blue silk scarf into the air. "This will mark the spot for us when we return." As she cantered on, she shook out her hair. Until now she had covered it with a wide meshed silk net. Mansur was astonished by its length, as it floated over her shoulders in a dense honey-brown cloud, thick and lustrous in the soft evening sunlight. With her hair down, her appearance was completely altered. She seemed to have become a wild thing, free and unfettered by the restraints of society and convention. Mansur had fallen a little behind her, but he was content to follow and watch her. He felt a deep longing welling within him. "This is my woman. This is the one I have waited and longed for." As he thought it, he caught a flicker of movement ahead of her running horse. It might have been the flit of the wings of one of the drab little thrushes, but he knew it was not. He concentrated his attention, and the complete picture leapt into his mind. It was a lion. The lash of its tail had alerted him. It was crouching in a shallow gully directly in Verity's path. It was flattened against the ground, which was the same pale brown as its sleek hide. Its ears were laid flat against its skull so that it looked like a monstrous serpent coiled to strike. Its eyes were an implacable gold. There was pink froth on its thin black lips and a lance wound high in its shoulder, which had angled down to pierce the lung. "Verity!" Mansur screamed. "It's there, right in your path! Turn back! For God's sake, turn back!" She looked back over her shoulder, her green eyes wide with surprise. He did not realize that he had shouted at her in English. Perhaps she was so taken aback by his change of language that she did not understand the import. She made no effort to check her mare and galloped on towards the crouching lion. Mansur spurred his stallion to the top of his speed, but he had dropped too far back to catch them. At the last moment the mare sensed the presence of the lion and shied violently to one side. Verity was almost hurled from the saddle, but she snatched at the pommel and prevented herself going right over. She lost her seat, however, and one foot was out of its stirrup. As she was thrown forward over the mare's neck, she hung on with both arms. The mare threw her head at the stench of the lion, and the reins were jerked from Verity's hand. She was no longer in control. The lion charged at the mare from the side. It was uttering deep, chesty grunts, and with each one bloody froth burst from its lips. The mare pivoted away, and Verity was flung to one side, hanging down her flank with one foot trapped in the stirrup. The lion sprang upwards with both front paws reaching out, the claws fully extended, great yellow hooks that could slice through the hide and muscle to the bone. It struck the mare with a force that sent her staggering back on her haunches, but the lion's claws were sunk into her hindquarters. The mare shrilled with terror and agony and kicked out both back legs. Verity was trapped between the two plunging bodies, and her screams cut across Mansur's nerves. It sounded as though she was mortally wounded. His stallion was already at full charge. Mansur couched his lance and steered the horse under him with his heels, altering the angle of his attack, reaching forward with the bright lance head dancing before him like a silver insect. The lion humped up over the mare's back, hanging on to her with the strength of those massive forelegs as she reared and bucked. It was roaring in a continuous bellow of sound. Its flanks were roped with muscle, and the rack of its ribs was clearly outlined beneath the skin. He aimed the lance just behind the straining shoulder. It struck cleanly, exactly at the spot he had intended. He ran the steel in with the impetus of the stallion's weight. It was almost effortless, just the jar as the steel touched bone, then glided on to transfix the lion from shoulder to shoulder. The beast arched its spine backwards in mortal agony, and the shaft of the lance snapped like a reed. The mare tore herself free of the hook claws and raced away, the blood from her wounds slicked down her quarters. Still writhing and contorting, the lion rolled in the low scrub. Verity was half under the mare, clinging to the side of her neck, one foot still trapped in a stirrup. If she lost her grip, she would be thrown to the ground and dragged along, with the back of her head bouncing along on the stones until her skull cracked open like an eggshell. She had no more breath to spare for screams. She hung on with all her strength as the mare bolted. Despite the bloody gashes in her hindquarters, the horse ran hard. She was mad with terror. Her eyeballs rolled back until the red lining of the sockets glared and silver ropes of saliva trailed from her open mouth. Verity tried to pull herself back into the saddle, but her efforts merely goaded the mare to greater speed. In extreme terror, she seemed endowed with fresh strength. Mansair dropped the broken stub of the lance and shouted at the stallion, hammering his heels into the animal's heaving flanks, whipping him across the shoulders with the loose ends of his reins. But he could not catch the mare. They raced back down the slope, and at the bottom the mare turned towards the ancient riverbed. Mansair sent the stallion after her. For half a mile they ran on, and the gap between the horses never changed, until the mare's dreadful injuries began to tell. Her stride shortened almost imperceptibly, and her back hooves began to throw outside the line of her run. "Hold hard, Verity!" Mansair shouted encouragement. "I am gaining on you now. Don't let go!" Then he saw the brink of the precipice open directly ahead of the mare, and he looked down the sheer wall of rock into the river valley 200 feet below. Black despair clamped down on his heart as he imagined mare and girl hurled out over the cliff and dropping to the rocks far beneath. He drove the stallion on with the strength of his arms and legs and fierce resolve in his heart. The mare weakened visibly, and the gap between them closed, but only slowly. At the last moment the mare saw the earth open ahead of her and tried to turn away, but as her front hooves bit into the loose earth of the rim, it broke away under her. She reared and teetered in wild panic, then toppled backwards. As the mare went over, Mansair threw himself from the back of the stallion, and on the edge of the precipice he reached out and grabbed Verity's ankle. He was almost jerked out over the drop, but then her stirrup leather snapped and her leg was free. Still, her weight dragged him face down on the sill, but he held on with all his strength. The mare fell away under them, dropping 50 feet before striking the cliff face and screaming in terror as she bounded out into the void. Verity swung like a pendulum, dangling upside down from his right hand by one leg. The skirts of her coat fell over her head, but she dared not move, knowing that it might break his precarious grip on her ankle. She could hear his harsh panting above her, but she dared not look up. Then his voice reached her. "Stay like that. I am going to pull you up." His voice was strangled with the effort. Even in her dreadful predicament, she took note that he was still speaking English. Unaccented and sweet in her ears, the voice of home. "If I must die, let that be the last sound I hear," she thought, but could not trust her own voice to reply to him. She looked down through the dizzying space to the valley floor so far below her. Her head swam with vertigo, but she hung quiescent and felt his hard fingers biting into her ankle through the soft leather of her boot. Above her, Mansair grunted with the effort, and the rough rock of the cliff scraped against her hip as she was drawn upwards a few inches by his strength. Blindly, Mansair groped backwards with one leg and found a narrow cleft in the rock. He shoved his knee and thigh deeply into it. It anchored him, and now he could release his left hand, with which he had been clinging, to a precarious hold. He reached down over the sill of the cliff and locked both hands onto Verity's ankle. "I have you now with both hands." His voice was harsh with the effort. "Courage, girl!" More decisively, she was pulled upwards. He paused to gather himself. "And a tiger?" Mansur gasped out the old nautical exhortation to encourage himself and her. She wanted to scream at him to shut his mouth, to eschew the childish nonsense and use all his strength to lift her. She knew that the difficult part still lay ahead when he had to heave her backwards over the rock rim. He pulled again, and she was dragged up another short space. There was a pause, and she felt him adjusting and strengthening his position, using his hips to wriggle backwards, trying to wedge his other leg into the cleft in the rock. He pulled again more strongly from his enhanced position, and she was lifted higher. "God love you for this," she whispered, just loud enough for him to hear, and he heaved again so hard she felt her leg might be pulled out of its socket in her hip. "Nearly there, Verity," he said, and pulled. By this time she did not move. A small shrub had taken root in a crack in the cliff face. Now its branches had hooked into her breeches. He pulled again, but he could not budge her. She was firmly held by the wiry bush.
"I can't move you," Mansur grunted. "Something holding you."
"It's a bush, catching my legs," she whispered. "Try to reach it," he ordered.
"Hold me," she replied,
and bent her body at the waist, reaching up with one hand. She felt the branches under her fingers and made a quick grab at them.
"Got them?" he demanded. "Yes."
But her grip was one-handed and tenuous. Then her heart turned to ice in her chest as she felt the boot he was holding begin to slide slowly off her foot.
"Boot's coming off!"
she sobbed out. "Give me your other hand," he panted. Before she could refuse, she felt him release one hand from her ankle and reach down along her leg. Her foot slid further out of the soft leather boot.
"Your hand!" he pleaded.
His fingers were scrabbling urgently down her thigh towards where the bush had come up against her and blocked her way. She felt the back of her boot ride down under her heel.
"Boot's going! I shall fall! Your hand, for the love of God! Give me your hand!"
She lunged upwards, and their fingers locked. She still had a grip on the bush with her other hand. Mansur was hanging on to the ankle of the boot, but now his right hand was linked to hers. Verity was doubled up, suspended by both arms and one leg. The skirt of her coat fell away from her face so she could see again. His face above her was flushed and swollen, his beard was dark, sodden with sweat. It dripped into her upturned face. Neither dared move.
"What must I do?" she said.
But before he could answer, it was decided for them. The boot slid off her foot. Her lower body dropped forcefully, then flicked round. Now she was stretched out, arms upwards and feet down. Although the jerk had loosened her grip, she was still clinging to his right hand and to the bush. Both were drenched with sweat, which greased their skin. His fingers began to slide through hers.
"I can't hold on to you," she gasped. "The bush," he said. "Don't let go of the bush!"
Though she felt as though he were crushing the bones of her fingers, their grip parted like a faulty chain-link, and she dropped again until the bush broke her fall. It cracked and bent with her weight.
"It will not hold!" she screamed. "I can't reach you!"
He was groping for her with both hands, and she was stretching up with her free hand, but she was just beyond his reach.
"Pull! You must pull yourself up so I can get you!" he grated.
She felt the ice in her heart numbing her muscles. She knew it was over. He saw the despair in her eyes, saw her grip on the bush start to fail. She was going to let go. He snarled at her savagely, trying to shock her into a last effort.
"Pull, you feeble creature! Pull, damn your lily liver!"
The insult stung her, and anger gave her the strength for one more attempt. But she knew it was useless. Even if she could reach him, their sweat-slimy hands could not hold together. She lunged for the branch and found a double hold, but the bush could no longer bear her weight. It crackled and snapped as it tore.
"I am going!" she sobbed.
"No, damn you, no!" he shouted. But the bush gave way. She started to fall. But suddenly both her wrists were seized and held. Her fall was arrested with a strength that made the joints of her upper arms pop in their sockets. Mansur had made his last effort. He had freed his legs from the cleft in which he had wedged them and threw himself forward over the lip of the cliff. At the full stretch of body and arms he had just reached her. He was hanging head down. Only his toes hooked into the rock cleft held him. but he had to raise her before she slipped through his fingers again. He braced his elbows against the face of the cliff and slowly bent his arms, raising her until they were face to face. His features were swollen and contorted with the agony of his straining muscles and with the rush of blood into his inverted head.
"I cannot lift you higher," he breathed, with their lips almost touching. "Climb up my body. Use me as a ladder."
She locked one arm through his, the bend of her elbow through the bend in his. This left his other hand free. He reached down and took hold of her leather belt and pulled her a little higher. She grabbed his belt buckle and they pulled together. He reached lower and took a handful of the seat of her breeches. She hooked her other arm between his legs, and again they heaved. Now her face was level with his waist, and she could see over the top of the cliff. He reached down, linked his fingers together, and made a stirrup for her bare foot. With the purchase this gave her, she could drag herself up and over the lip. She sprawled on the rock for only an instant, then whipped round.
"Can you get back?" she gasped.
He was fully extended, powerless to pull himself backwards and regain the crest. He was almost too far gone to articulate coherently.
"Get the horse," he gasped. "Rope on saddle. Pull me back with the horse."
She glanced around and saw the stallion a quarter of a mile away, trotting back up the valley.
"Your horse is gone."
Mansa reached backwards and tried to find a finger-hold on the rock, but it was smooth. There was a tiny rasping sound as the toe of one boot moved in the rock crack. He slid forward an inch towards the edge of the cliff. Then his foot caught again. She was frozen with horror. His toe-hold was all that held him from the drop. She seized his ankle with both hands, but she knew it was hopeless. She could never hope to hold the weight of such a big man. She tried to brace herself as she watched his foot slip again, and then his hold in the cleft broke. He slid forward irresistibly, and his ankle was plucked from her hands. He shouted as he went over the edge, and she flung herself forward across the rock sill to peer down, expecting to see him falling away with his robes ballooning around him. Then she stared in disbelief. The hem of his white robe had snagged on a shard of granite on the lip of the cliff. It had broken his fall. Now he was swinging like a pendulum just below her, dangling over that dizzying void. She stretched down with one hand to try to reach him.
"Give me your hand," she called.
She was weak with her own efforts to escape, and her hand shook wildly.
"You will never hold me."
He looked up at her, and there was no fear in his eyes. That touched her deeply.
"Let me try," she pleaded.
"No," he said. "One of us will go, not both."
"Please," she whispered.
And the hem of his robe tore with a sharp ripping sound.
"I could not bear it if you died for me."
"Worth it," he said softly, and she felt her heart break. She sobbed and looked behind her. Then hope bloomed again. She slid back from the edge and wedged herself firmly into the rock cleft. She reached back over her shoulders and seized a double handful of her dense brown hair, pulled it forward and twisted it into a loose rope that hung below her waist. Then she threw herself flat onto the rock sill. She was just able to see over the edge. The rope of her hair tumbled forward.
"Take my hair!" she shouted.
He swiveled his head and stared up at her as it brushed lightly against his face.
"Do you have purchase? Can you hold me?" "Yes, I am wedged into the rock cleft."
She tried to sound confident, but she thought, "Even if I can't, we will go together." He twisted her hair round his wrist, and with a final crack of tearing cloth, the hem of his robe gave way. She had just time to brace herself before the shock of his full weight dropping onto her hair half stunned her. Her head was jerked forward, and her cheek slammed into the rock with a force that jarred her teeth. She was pinned down. She felt the vertebra in her neck popping, as though she were hanged on the gallows. Mansa hung on the rope of her hair only for the seconds it took him to orient. Then he climbed up, hand over hand, swiftly as a topyard sailor going up the main shrouds. She screamed involuntarily, for it seemed that her scalp was being torn from her skull. But then he reached past her, found a handhold in the rock cleft, and heaved himself over the rim of the cliff. He turned instantly, seized her in his arms, and dragged her back to safety. He held her to his chest and pressed his face against the top of her head, knowing how intense must be the agony of her scalp. She lay in his arms, weeping, as though in bitter mourning. He rocked her gently, as though she were an infant, mumbling incoherent words of comfort and gratitude. After a while she stirred against him, and he thought she was trying to escape his embrace. He opened his arms to free her, but she reached up and slipped her arms around the back of his neck. She pressed herself to his chest, and their bodies seemed to melt together like hot wax through their sweat-soaked clothing. Her sobbing stilled. And then, without pulling away from him, she lifted her face and looked into his eyes.
"You saved my life," she whispered.
"And you saved mine," he replied. The tears still cascaded down her face, and her lips were trembling. He kissed her, and her lips opened without resistance. Her tears tasted of salt, and her mouth of fragrant herbs. Her hair fell in a tent over them. It was a lingering kiss, and ended only when they were forced to breathe.
"You are not an Arab," she whispered. "You are an Englishman."
"You have found me out," he said, and kissed her again. When they drew apart, she said,
"I am so confused. Who are you?"
"I will tell you," he promised, "but later." He sought her lips again, and she gave them willingly. After a while she placed both her hands on his shoulders and pushed him back gently.
"Please, Mansur, we must stop this. If we don't, something will happen that will spoil everything before it has begun."
"It has begun already, Verity."
"Yes, I know it has," she said.
"It began when first I laid eyes on you on the deck of the Arcturus."
"I know,"
she said again, and stood up quickly. With both hands she flung the glorious profusion of her hair back from her face and over her shoulders.
"They are coming."
She pointed back up the valley at the band of horsemen who were galloping towards them.